Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
The DSW Black Friday sale is on. Take 30% off almost everything in stores and online right now. Yep, you heard that right. 30% off. Stock up on new shoes, bags, and extras for you and yours from all the gift-worthy brands you love. But hurry, Black Friday can't last forever. Get to your DSW store or DSW.com ASAP to save big. Exclusions apply. Details at DSW.com.
Hold that, sir. There's no time for pickleball because you're going to want to hear this. Noom now has GLP-1s.
No way!
Oh, yes way, Fred. Psychology and meds. That's how Noom helps you lose the weight and keep it off.
That's really smart.
Oh, Danny, it's Noom smart. And they start at just $149 and they're shipped to your door in 7 days.
Holy smokes, that's fast!
But not as fast as my service game.
Hey,
who's ready to get pickled?
Get started with Noom GLP-1 today. Not all customers will medically qualify for prescription medications. Compounded medications are not reviewed by the FDA for safety, efficacy, or quality.
Welcome to the Serial Killer Podcast, the podcast dedicated to serial killers, who they were, what they did, and how. Episode 240. I am your humble host, Thomas Roseland Vyborg Thun. This episode is published on what we here in Norway call Little Christmas Eve, the day before Christmas Eve. As some of my listeners may know, here in Norway, the main Christmas celebration takes place on Christmas Eve, not Christmas Day, as is the custom in the US and UK, and other countries as well. Also, in Norway, we do not say Christmas, which in Norwegian would be Kristmesse. We say Jul, which is a direct continuation of the Norse pagan word Julablot, which was a big feast held during winter solstice here in the High North before the country was converted to Christianity. Anyway, to all my very dear listeners, I wish you all a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and God Jul. And now, or something completely different, the life and crimes of Charles Manson and the chaos he left in his wake. Enjoy. This episode, like all other sagas told by me, would not be possible without my loyal Patreonies. They are Elizabeth, Lisa, Kathy, Corbin, Craig, Jonathan, Lunavar, Cheryl, Richard, Brad, Manuel, Ayulen, and Ricky. You are truly the backbone of the Serial Killer Podcast, and without you, there would be no show. Patreon is again filled with ad-free episodes for my TSK Producers Club, and I also have a bonus episode I'm quite happy with for my $10 Plus Club members. It's a movie review, and this time the film in question is the serial killer film Long Legs. So don't miss out and head on over to patreon.com/theserialkillerpodcast now.
Mm-hmm.
Manson case has been surrounded by numerous unanswered questions for 50 years. Here are a few examples. The killers targeted strangers for murder. Previously, non-violent kids, except for Atkins, none of them had a criminal record, killed for Manson, on command, with such abandon and lack of remorse. If Manson hoped to ignite a world-ending race war, he did not order more killings after the two nights of murder did not trigger the war. Vincent Bugliosi made a fortune and achieved worldwide fame from his prosecution of the Manson family and the book Helter Skelter. Over the years, many people in law enforcement have expressed that they never believed the Helter Skelter motive. Their theories were always more mundane, suggesting less sensational motives, which would have made for less compelling reading in Bugliosi's book. Eventually, all the killers settled on a story similar to the one Atkins told after her attorney swap. All of them have sought parole releases based on that story's thesis, that they were not responsible for their actions because they were under Manson's control. Many of the psychiatrists who testified said that the defendants' minds had been so decimated by LSD that they likely had no way of discerning real memories from false ones. They may not have known if they were at either house on the night of the killings, let alone whether they participated in the murders. The only person who never endorsed Atkins' final story and the Helter Skelter motive along with it was Charles Manson. After his conviction, he said little about the crime, except that he didn't know what his children were going to do before they did it, and that he had no explanation for why they had done it. Curiously, Bugliosi admitted in one of his last interviews that he was pretty certain Manson never believed in Helter Skelter. He told Rolling Stone, and here I quote, "I think everyone who participated in the murders bought the Helter Skelter theory hook, line, and sinker. But did Manson himself believe in all this ridiculous, preposterous stuff about all of them living in a bottomless pit in the desert while a worldwide war went on outside? I think, without knowing, that he did not." End quote. Unfortunately, the reporter did not follow up with the further inquiry into Bugliosi's statement. If the murders weren't committed to incite a race war, then it would be natural to ask what the motive or motives actually were. In the chilling aftermath of the Tate murders, one of the most perplexing clues emerged from the chaos: a pair of eyeglasses found in Sharon Tate's living room. These glasses belonged to neither the victims nor the known killers, and seemed to belong to none at all. The detectives were left scratching their heads, as no explanation was ever given that satisfied anyone. Fast forward to 1986, in a book titled Manson in His Own Words, purportedly co-authored by Manson and ex-convict Newell Emmons. Manson himself sheds light on this enigmatic piece of evidence. According to Manson, he visited the Cielo Drive house with a mysterious accomplice, taking careful steps to manipulate the crime scene. He writes, and I quote, "My partner had an old pair of eyeglasses, which we often used as a magnifying glass or a device to start a fire when matches weren't available. We carefully wiped the glasses free of prints and dropped them on the floor, so that, when discovered, they would be a misleading clue for the police." End quote. However, it's crucial to approach this revelation with skepticism. Manson, in his own words, is hardly a bastion of reliability. Emmons penned the book long after conducting personal interviews with Manson, where recording or note-taking was forbidden. Moreover, Manson later offered a vague disavowal of the book, although not before he and Emmons appeared together in televised interviews to promote it. This leaves us with more questions than answers, deepening the mystery of the glasses and the true extent of Manson's orchestration behind the scenes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes see details.
The DSW Black Friday sale is on. Take 30% off almost everything in stores and online right now. Yep, you heard that right. 30% off. Stock up on new shoes, bags, and extras for you and yours from all the gift-worthy brands you love. But hurry, Black Friday can't last forever. Get to your DSW store or DSW.com ASAP to save big. Exclusions apply. Details at DSW.com.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
From his prison cell, Charles Manson wrote a secretive note to Linda Kasabian, using a code that's difficult to decode. It seems he might have been confessing to leaving the glasses at the Cielo Drive house after the murders. This note appears to have been an attempt to dissuade Kasabian from cooperating with the prosecution. The note, penned in person by Charles Manson, reads as follows, and I quote, "So, what if I did make you do it? I don't care if you're a snitch. You've been a lying bitch. I did what I did because I felt it was to be done, and I even put the eyeglasses to where I could show you all are blind and give them shorty. Each time you skiv down, you think of Sharon Tate. And no, that's you, if I can't get to my Nancy's love. Tell Gold to hold the boneyard, and no bones outside the yard." End quote. Deciphering Charles Manson's words is always challenging, but this particular note is less obscure than his usual communications. Gold was his nickname for Nancy Pittman, one of his favored family members, whom he had earlier called Nancy in the same message. In early 1970, Pittman was a regular visitor to the jail defendants, acting on Manson's instructions. She urged Linda Kasabian not to testify against them, and advised Susan Atkins to stop cooperating with the prosecution. Shorty refers to Donald Shorty Shea, the Spahn Ranch caretaker killed by the family, whose body was not found until 1977. If one were to speculate, Manson might have been cautioning Kasabian against turning informant
while also instructing her to convey to Gold during her next visit that Shea's remains should not be disturbed from their burial site at the Spahn Ranch. Moreover, Manson could have been alluding to other possible victims buried there, fueling long-standing suspicions of additional undiscovered graves. While the note's content is sensational, the critical point here is Manson's subtle admission that he revisited the Tate residence post-murder to place the glasses there. And so it is, dear listener, that we circle back to one of this saga's great antagonists, Vincent Bugliosi. As I have laid out for you, his case against Charles Manson and his followers was riddled with inaccuracies and falsehoods. So let us take a closer look at some other actions this very famous attorney and author had been up to during his career. In 1968, Vincent Bugliosi became embroiled in a scandal that the district attorney's office kept secret until 1972, when Bugliosi was running for the position of Los Angeles district attorney. He ultimately lost this election. Bugliosi had stalked and terrorized someone he was convinced had an affair with his wife and fathered his firstborn child, Vincent Jr. Despite sounding like a cliché, Bugliosi suspected his milkman, Herbert Weisel, who was married with two children. Weisel had left his job in 1965, 8 months before Vincent Jr. was born. Bugliosi was certain that Weisel had quit because of his infidelity, believing the evidence must be in Weisel's personal file at the dairy. He made anonymous calls to Weisel's wife, and then directly to Weisel, demanding access to his files. The couple noticed strange cars circling their block at night. They changed their phone number, despite it already being unlisted. 2 days later, they received a typed letter from Los Angeles, stating, and I quote, "You shouldn't have changed your phone number. That wasn't nice." End quote. Eventually, Bugliosi's wife, Gail, approached the Weisels, revealing her identity in hopes of brokering peace. The Weisels suggested that Bugliosi needed psychiatric help. She allegedly told them that she'd tried many times, but that he wouldn't do it. Gail had taken paternity and lie detector tests to reassure Bugliosi of his paternity, but he remained doubtful. As I have stated several times earlier, a lie detector is pure humbug. So I understand Bugliosi's skepticism of that procedure, but not the paternity test. It is quite clear that Bugliosi had mental issues that sorely needed to be addressed. The Weisels, increasingly frightened, stopped allowing their children to ride the school bus and hired a lawyer. Following mediation, Bugliosi agreed to cease his harassment and offered $100 for their silence, which they refused. In 1972, with Bugliosi on the ballot, the Weisels felt it was their civic duty to expose their tormentor, who was aspiring to be the city's top law enforcement officer. They detailed his year-long campaign of harassment and intimidation to the press. Bugliosi, using his well-documented skill in fabrication, retaliated by claiming Weisel had stolen money from his kitchen table 7 years prior. Weisel sued for slander and defamation, a case he easily won. In depositions, Bugliosi and his wife claimed they were only concerned about the alleged theft. However, the Weisels brought forward witnesses who contradicted this, revealing the Bugliosis as perjurers. It emerged that Bugliosi had twice used an investigator from the DA's office to obtain confidential information about Weisel, under the pretense that Weissel was a material witness in a murder case. Fearing for his job, Bugliosi settled out of court, paying the Weissels $12,500 in cash, with the stipulation that they sign a confidentiality agreement and surrender the deposition tapes. No sooner had the milkman issue been resolved than Bugliosi found himself in another scandal, once again leveraging his legal connections to manage to fall out. His mistress, Virginia Cardwell, a single mother of a five-year-old, informed him she was pregnant with his child. With political ambitions still in mind, and his book Helter Skelter about to be published, he instructed Cardwell, who was Catholic, to have an abortion. She refused, but after Bugliosi threatened her and gave her money, she falsely claimed she had complied. Unconvinced, Bugliosi obtained her doctor's name, called him, and discovered she hadn't visited. He then went to her apartment and violently attacked her, causing a miscarriage. He choked her, punched her face repeatedly, threw her to the ground, dragged her up by her hair, and threatened to kill her if she had the baby, warning, and I quote, "I will break every bone in your body. This will ruin my career," end quote. Cardwell, severely bruised, went to the Santa Monica Police Department to file a complaint. The police took photos of her injuries, but did not act further. A vigilant reporter spotted the incident in the police blotter, leading to a story in the next day's paper. That morning, Bugliosi returned with his secretary, effectively holding Cardwell hostage for 4 hours until she agreed to retract her complaint. Bugliosi promised to use his DA office connections to ensure she wouldn't face charges for the so-called false report. They used Cardwell's typewriter to create a backdated bill for legal services, which she was instructed to present to the police. Bugliosi listened in as Cardwell called to withdraw her complaint, though despite his disapproval, the police sent a car anyway. Detective Michael Landis, who saw Cardwell that day, recounted that Bugliosi and a couple of his associates tried to prevent them from speaking with her, but they persisted and noted her injuries. Cardwell claimed the bruises were from an accident involving her son and a baseball bat, saying she blamed Bugliosi out of anger over his legal fees for her divorce advice. Bugliosi stated, and I quote, "This outrageous charge, even though false, can be extremely harmful," end quote. Persuaded by her brother, Cardwell filed a lawsuit against Bugliosi. His defense quickly unraveled, and he settled out of court to maintain confidentiality, hoping to keep his violent crime, lies, evidence fabrication, and obstruction of justice hidden. However, the story broke in 1974 during his campaign for California Attorney General, which he also lost. Bugliosi was never prosecuted for the assault on Cardwell. Detective Landis described him as, and here I quote, "a whiny, snivelly little bastard," end quote. Knowing how many faults can be laid at the former DA's feet, and how he evidently never shied away from breaking the law to suit his needs, it is no surprise that there were crimes committed by the Manson family that has never been properly dealt with by the authorities. On the 29th of September 1969, a 23-year-old by the name of Filippo Tenarelli, fresh from his parents' nest, rolled out in his brand spanking new Volkswagen Beetle. This wasn't your average Sunday drive. No. Tenarelli, an Italian native who'd swapped Italy for Los Angeles back in 1959, had a dark plan brewing under his slicked-back hair. No criminal record. No known mental health issues. Just a man with a mission. He drove from Culver City, the engine purring along the desolate roads, all the way to Father Crowley Point in Death Valley National Park. Picture this, a place where the desert stretches out like an endless scorched canvas, where you can see for miles under the unforgiving sun. But Tenarelli wasn't there for the view. He aimed to end it all, to send that beetle and himself over the edge into oblivion. But fate, or God, or happenstance, had other plans. The beetle caught on some boulders and hung there like a stubborn mule. High from the adrenaline rush coming from anger and frustration, Tenarelli grabbed a pickaxe and shovel from the trunk. He hacked at the rocks, dislodging the car. Then, in a twist of rage, or maybe a last-minute change of heart, he shoved the car over the cliff. It tumbled down, 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 flipping end over end, to crash, wheels up 400 feet below. That's around 121 meters. He scrambled down the jagged rocks, cut his hands on something inside the wreckage, leaving his blood as a grim signature on the car's ceiling. What he did next is anyone's guess. The next we hear of him is in Bishop, California, 100 miles of mystery later, on the evening of the 30th. Tenarelli checked into the Sportsman's Lodge Motel, room number 3, with another attempt at suicide on his mind. He slashed his wrist, but it was just a scratch, barely a whisper of his intent. He bandaged it up, went shopping the next day for a 20-gauge shotgun, ammo, the works. He also grabbed whiskey, underwear, a razor, and a copy of Playboy, setting the stage for his final act. That night, Tenarelli emerged from his motel room when he heard fire engines. The fire department was doing a controlled demolition of a building across the street. The motel owner, B. Greer, was watching, and she told Tenarelli what was going on. He observed the fire for a while and returned to his room. No one saw him alive again. The next morning, no one saw Tenarelli leave. A maid couldn't get into his room. It had been barricaded from within. By noon, after some muscle from Greer's husband and son, they broke in. There was Tenarelli, dead, a shotgun blast to the face, lying on the floor in just his jeans. His head resting on Turkish towels, maybe to soak up the blood, a pillow over his face, possibly to muffle the sound of his departure from this world. And here's the kicker. All his pubic hair had been shaved off, some found between the pages of the aforementioned Playboy. When he checked in, he used someone else's name. He had no ID, no official identity. So, to police, he became just another John Doe. On the 3rd of October, Tenarelli's family filed a missing persons report. The next day, two hunters stumbled upon his overturned beetle at the base of Father Crowley Point and alerted the California Highway Patrol. An officer investigated, noticed blood on the ceiling, and suspected foul play. The family was informed that their son's car had been found abandoned in Death Valley. For 3 weeks, the Bishop Police Department attempted to identify their John Doe, while the county sheriff's office searched for the missing Tenarelli. However, these parallel investigations never crossed paths, despite the departments sharing adjacent stations in Bishop and utilizing the same coroner's office. On the 30th of October, the In Ohio Register announced that the suicide victim was positively identified as Filippo Tanarelli from Culver City. Identification was confirmed through x-rays matching his records from an LA hospital. Soon after, this case was overshadowed in local news by a more sensational story. A group of nomadic hippies, arrested in a remote part of Death Valley for property destruction and auto theft, were linked to the brutal murders of Sharon Tate and seven others in Los Angeles. Although not publicized at the time, the Inyo County Sheriff's Office and the California Highway Patrol briefly entertained the notion that this so-called family could be behind Tanarelli's death. Documents later revealed that investigators harbored doubts about Tanarelli committing suicide. There was evidence suggesting family members' involvement. These suspicions were hinted at in a Los Angeles Times article 2 weeks after the family faced charges for the Tate-LaBianca killings, which mentioned inquiries into other possible family-related murders, including one of a quote-unquote motorcyclist killed in Bishop. 6 months later, a Rolling Stone article cited an insider from the Los Angeles DA's office, identified as Aaron Stovitz, who implied that the death of a Philip Tanarelli might be the work of the family. However, the article did not disclose what specific evidence or leads prompted such suspicions. By 2007, when the research into Tanarelli's death commenced, documents linking Tanarelli to the Manson family had not been seen by anyone outside of law enforcement circles. And with that, we come to the end of part 9 in this series covering Charles Manson. The next episode will end this record-long serial killer exposé. So as they say in the land of radio, stay tuned.